times larger and the spark gap 30 times bigger, that doesn't mean that the human being is going to suddenly lose the skin effect. The current's going to flow through his body, and now he's going to holler. It's only the current that flows into your bloodstream that allows you to physically sense current flowing through your body. The current that flows across the skin, unless it's with Don Lodge that it creates heating, you don't know about it. It doesn't give you the nerve effect that you and I call electrocution. So there's a bunch of mysteries going on here. As you start translating their Russian language and figure out what they're saying to each other, and maybe there's another, and these YouTube videos, let me drop them. Quite often these YouTube videos, when you go to the site of one and you wait until it plays all the way through, they'll give you two or three more selectable YouTube videos which are related to the same event. And so maybe there's a YouTube video 1, 2, and 3 on this whole assembly. And maybe with those guys talking to each other on those other YouTube videos, there's a little bit of an explanation as to what was that circuit and what was the test that they were doing. So a lot of unknowns here, Wes. And so it ain't clear, and it's a bit of a mystery. N2XJN, KQLIW, the TechNet.
We spoke about it with Glenn, so I would like to send Mike right now to John, and he will be able to say more about it. John?
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, the only thing I noticed, if you play it back, you'll notice it also. When he is fooling around with it originally, we have an AC arc. That discharge at the end that they call an explosion, that was DC. And you can hear the difference. So I think you're right. That sounded more like a passive discharge to me. That doesn't explain anything, but that's one thing I noticed right off the bat. And there we don't have skin effect.
There is another possibility here, John, and that is the actual circuit itself. He's drawing an arc because of the AC voltage that's on it. There could have been simultaneous DC voltage. And during the second experiment, the possibility exists that his right hand is holding on to the welding rod that's going to be brought close to the circuit and create the arc. His left hand may have touched something that was grounded. And now the simultaneous AC and DC going into his body, the DC component is, let me pick a number, a 5,000 volt power supply backed up with a 150 microfarad capacitor. And now that capacitor, the DC voltage is discharging through that human being. That would make a very loud sound, make him extremely uncomfortable. And he's a lucky guy that he didn't get electrocuted if that was happening. So we don't know, but I think the possibility exists that that circuit had simultaneous AC and DC on it. And maybe he didn't know that. Wonder if anybody considered that possibility, Wes. Into XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, the guy is following the old communist rules that we were all taught about. You have to play with it with two hands. And I see from the video right now, I'm looking at it, I don't have a voice because I put it down, that the guy is playing only with one hand, and the second hand he has very much secured, so he's not touching it. Also, he's not sitting on anything. So the shoes are directly on the wooden floor. And Glenn has a different idea about it, but I'm going to leave the pleasure, because we already spoke about it. I'm going to leave the pleasure of listening to Glenn explanation one more time. So I suggest we come back to that later on for even 1 minute, because Glenn is pretty fast with explaining this phenomenon. But actually it's related to very much concentrated E-field. And so it's here.
WS21.
Paul recognized that quite often Glenn signs in a little bit later. When he comes in, we'll discuss it at that time. Wonder if you saw that video, Paul, and what you think of it. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I haven't seen it yet. I'll have to get to that website and look. Maybe you can give that out again. But
you said it was a welding situation, you know, a lot of the Heliarc machines have an AC superimposed system current going at the same time that the DC is going. This way, when you contact the thoriated tip, you know, the torch to the work, nothing gets contaminated. You're not striking it off, per se, like you normally would do. If you do a welding, you just tend to take the end of it and strike the arc. So the superimposed AC creates an arc, and now you got your plasma, and once that's established, the DC will flow across that. You don't have any contamination, cross contaminations between the tip of the torch and the work. And the work stays pristine. You won't wind up with any you know, other chemicals except pure chemicals, you know, from the filler rod. Nothing from the torch, and vice versa. You don't destroy the torch either with whatever you're welding, you know, aluminum or whatever it might be. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the only thing that makes it look like welding is that as the pointer in his hand had touched the high voltage circuit, he was holding onto a welding rod. But from all we can tell, there was no other welding equipment in the area. This is a real high voltage, high frequency Tesla coil, we believe, is what the circuit actually is. And even though his other hand was in his pocket, still, and his shoes are standing on a wooden floor, and there's always the possibility that the circuit itself was somehow in connection with ground, and somehow his body became grounded. His waist moved over and touched a metal table. We're not quite sure what all happened, because portions of the human being are out of view of the camera during the time that you hear this very loud bang. And why in the world should just putting this this toroidal magnet on top of this Tesla coil, why should it make such a big change, is a darn interesting question. Tesla coils usually have a large metallic object on the top to make sure that you decrease the amount of corona discharge. A pointy object with high voltage will give you a very rapid corona discharge, which discharges your circuit, and you don't get a chance to build up a high voltage. You put a large, rounded metallic object on the top of your Tesla coil, then it's allowed to build up a great big voltage, and when it finally does break down the air, you draw a nice big arc. So when Glenn comes in later on, we'll go back to that particular subject, Wes, and a bit of a mystery there. And apparently, as you translated their Russian, there wasn't yet enough explanation as to what was the circuit, and maybe if we do enough search on the adjacent websites, there may be other websites showing other YouTube videos of that exact circuit, which...
Repeater, time out.
There may be other YouTube videos of that exact circuit. The YouTube video itself, Paul, it's got a great big long address, so you're going to have to get that from either Wes or from Bernie's website. And by the way, Andy, WHUCDL, wanted to get a hold of you with reference to some information on welding. So, maybe he did or maybe he didn't find your phone number. And if not, if you get a chance to look up Andy, the B2CDL, and call him, he'd like to have a quick conversation with you, Paul. So that's something to consider. We'll go on to the next Joe if he's still there. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Are you there, Joe? KQLAW in the TechNet.
It's already done, Dick, by the way. Thank you.
Very fine. Joe number two, are you there? Okay, we'll go on to Mark. Kilo 2 Charlie Sierra X-ray. Go right ahead, Mark. K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Mark got called away. And now we'll go to Mike. Whiskey Kilo 3 India. Go right ahead, Mike. K2LAW in the TechNet. And this is amazing. Joe number two is not there. Mark is not there. And Mike is not there. Did all these guys suddenly disappear? Let me go through that list again. Joe number two, Kilo Charlie 2 Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Are you there, Joe? Apparently not. Mark, Kilo 2 Charlie Sierra X-ray. Are you there, Mark? K2LIW. And Mike, Whiskey Kilo 3 India. Are you there, Mike? Hello, anybody? K2LIW.
Alien abduction, Dick, NY2H.
Yeah, well, we're all listening to you, Dick, N2MB.
Very fine, then. Okay, Barry and NY2H, terrible tonight. Looks like I'm having trouble getting anybody to answer. So I guess we'll go to the mailbag a little earlier, John. Maybe you'll spend a little more time in the mailbag. Kilo Charlie 2, Whiskey Golf Alpha. KC2WGB. Hey, John, what kind of crazy questions you get this week? K2LIW in the tech den.
Do you ever feel like you're all alone? KC2WGB. Well, we got two this week. Very slow week this week. Very, very slow. I guess with all the things going on, some of the horrors, we haven't been getting too much. But, yeah, I have one. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to this one. Okay, we have a young amateur who has really made a nice crafty product. It seems to be working really well. He's made an antenna out of burglar alarm window foil. It's about maybe 3/8 of an inch wide and sticky back. What he did was he taped it onto a window shade, which he can roll up and put out of the way. So he built a 2-meter one on one side. It worked very well. Then he placed a 440 on the other side. They both come down to two PL259 connectors. Then he uses a bullet connector, uses them that way. His problem is, and he thinks maybe you could help him out, he has a great SWR on the 2-meter and fair on the 440. But he cannot tune the 440 as well as he can the 2-meter. What should he look for? And does that have anything with the vertical displacement in height on the reverse sides? What should he? What would be his next step to see what is causing his problems? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
That has a hint.
Well, I've got a picture of the foil antenna on the near side of the window shade, the 2-meter antenna on the near side, and the 440 antenna on the far side. They will couple to each other in some pretty nasty ways. If he took the 2-meter dipole and tilted it at a 45-degree angle as he mounted it on the window shade, and the 440 antenna on the back, he tilted it at a 45-degree angle also. So now the two of them at right angles to each other, they will not see each other. And that will make any cross-coupling between 2 meters and 440 a hell of a lot better. If he didn't have a lot of cross-coupling, every time he retunes the 2-meter antenna, he'd be simultaneously tuning the 440 and vice versa. So I would try to make them orthogonal by tilting them at a 45-degree angle on each side. But there's another whole issue going on here, John, and that is, what did he use for transmission line? I mean, where I've got a window shade that I want to wind up, let me drop. Where I've got a window shade that I want to wind up, and where I ordinarily would feed a small 2-meter antenna with, say, RG58 cable, the RG58 cable is not going to wind up so well on the window shade. Also, the weight of the RG58 cable, if it's not carefully glued down to the window shade, the weight of it is going to weigh on the foil of the dipole, and it's going to pull it away. And that's one thing to worry about. Also, the foil might be aluminum foil, in which case soldering to it is not easy. So how good is that solder joint is one thing to worry about. However, if he is crafty enough, using the window foil, he could curve it in such a way that the at least one side of the window foil curves at a 90-degree angle. He does a folding operation right at the center of the dipole and brings the window foil down to the bottom of the shade and makes contact to it there. By cutting a slot down the center of that foil that comes vertically away, perpendicular away from the dipole, he can make twin lead antenna, transmission line. Twin lead transmission line made out of foil with just the right spacing between the left side and the right side, cut just the right diameter, the right thickness of slot, would make a beautiful foldable transmission line to feed the dipole. Once he's got that foldable transmission line, that would be a very convenient arrangement. And when it comes to impedance matching a dipole, let me drop. If he goes to the Brown and Woodward curves, if he goes to the Tom Williams website, WA1MBA, whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, whiskeyalpha1mikebravoalpha.org, you go to that website, you go to the bottom of the website where it talks about Yagi impedance matching by K2RIW, and then you go to the next page on that, by clicking on that site, and you'll get three things. You'll get a resistive curve, a reactive curve, and an article. And the article tells you how to get perfect, and I mean perfect, impedance match to your dipole. And it doesn't matter if the dipole is in free space or if the dipole is buried in the middle of a Yagi. That article explains how to get a perfect impedance match. And what the article will tell you is, as you change the length of the dipole, you're doing two things. You're changing the reactive component and the resistive component. And if you're just looking at reflected power by measuring visual, so to speak, and you're looking at the reflected mode while transmitting into the antenna, you can do a tremendous amount of tuning by having in your hand a wooden stick that's, say, let me put a number, a foot long. You're using a wooden skewer, a barbecue skewer, and at the end of the barbecue skewer, you've got a small piece of copper tape or aluminum tape. Doesn't matter. But it is a capacitance in free space. Let me drop. And now as you take that tuning tool in your hand and you put it near the tips of the dipole, you're adding extra capacitance to the tip of the dipole as you hold it near. If the standing wave ratio goes down, you know that your dipole is a little bit too short. You're adding capacitance. You're tuning it to a lower frequency by adding the capacitance to the tip. Correspondingly, as you bring it near the tip of the dipole, if the standing wave ratio goes up, you know your dipole was too long to start off with. You got to shorten it. So that tuning tool, bringing it near the tips of the dipole, will tell you whether the dipole is too long or too short. Also, bringing it near the center of the dipole, when you're adding a shunt capacitor, does the visual get better or get go up or go down? It's like a blind man walking up a hill. That piece of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick, held near portions of your dipole, will tell you which way to go to make the dipole better and better in visual. And when you read that article, it tells you how to properly adjust the length of the dipole to get the right resistive component, then how to put, in usual cases, a shunt capacitor across the center of the dipole to make the visual perfect. And that shunt capacitor, let me drop. That shunt capacitor in the center of the dipole, and the dipoles that I have built out of sheet metal and out of foil, I made the shunt capacitor by putting a piece of copper tape directly across the gap on the center of the dipole, but there's a catch. It was in direct contact with the dipole on the left side. A piece of scotch tape was placed over the center of the dipole on the right side. Therefore, as I shunted it with that piece of copper tape, I wasn't creating a short circuit. I was creating a capacitor. By using the back end of that metal, of that wooden stick, I could then slowly peel up the copper tape in the center, and that made a variable capacitor. When you make a variable capacitor out of a shunting piece of copper tape or aluminum tape, where the actual insulator is a piece of scotch tape, your mind will say, gee, that looks like the yuckiest capacitor in the world. At 900 megacycles, where I was doing that, that is an extremely high performance capacitor. So you can make a variable capacitor in the center, watch the visual go up and down as you tune it by flapping the end of that, the copper tape is bent up a little bit away from the scotch tape, and by folding it down and letting it go back up, pushing it with the end of the stick, you're making a variable capacitor. And your tuning tool, by bringing it near the dipole tips, seeing if the visual goes up or down, by this tuning procedure, to a smart guy who's got a little bit of experience, within about 3 or 4 minutes, you can make every single dipole a perfect impedance match. Are you seeing the tuning procedure here, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
AC2WGB. Yes, I do, Dick. Very good advice. And I like the idea of him using the same aluminum foil for the feed line. Because right now he's using some RG174, which is a very fine, very flexible cable, very thin. And he brings that down to the PL239s at the bottom. So, all right, he should try to orientate them 45 degrees opposing. That may help him. And that sounds good to me also. But he had great luck with the 2-meter until he put the 440 on the other side. Then he had problems with the 440. 2-meter still works good. And it does roll up. And the other thing is, most of his windows are 32-inch width in a house, so he can move the antenna to any window he wants and just take his radio over there. He's having a lot of fun with it. But great advice, and I hope he's listening. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, what do you believe he's using as a balance? Is that miniature coax cable, is he simply bringing the shield to one side and the center conductor to the other side? Question number one. I'll get to you in a second, Wes. Question number one. Question number two, if it's aluminum tape, is he doing aluminum soldering? Because that's difficult. How's he actually making the contact? But if he's just bringing the coax cable there with no other balancing device, what he thinks is his transmission line is now part of the antenna, and it's doing radiating. And there's a way around that I can suggest. So back to you for those two questions first, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
It's hard to tell in the drawing or the photograph. I don't see what could be a balun. It looks like he has a coil on the 174, RG-174, but I'm not sure. Let's see. Now, as far as fasteners, he's actually using the tape fasteners, which are little plastic clips that have a metal grid, and it squeezes the aluminum tape in between it and has a direct connection for the coax cable. So he has a good firm connection. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, that's a good piece of information. Now, there's a way he can feed this dipole where it doesn't require a balun. Maybe he's got a poor man's balun. He's taken this miniature cable and made, let me pick a number, of 5 or 10 turns at the end, a couple inch diameter, held together with a tie wrap or something like that. So it's acting like an RF choke to the outer conductor and acting as a poor man's balun. That's one way he can do it. Another way he can do it is the dipole itself doesn't have to have a notch in the center. If he makes the dipole one continuous piece of tape, and then he folds around the outer tip, and he folds it back, so he looks like he's beginning to build a folded dipole, but he only does it on one side. Now the shield goes directly to the center of the dipole where the notch would have been, and it's connected to it, and the center conductor comes back to that folded dipole-like thing and connects to the center of it. And now, how do you make this half-folded dipole-type dipole? Which, by the way, the patent for that is held by WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. If you go to his website, go to Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, and you'll find Ken Britton's printed circuit green Yagis for 900 megacycles, for instance. But you go to his second page, where he has the poor man's Yagi antennas that are built out of coat hanger wire on wooden booms, 3, 4, 5 element Yagis for 2 meters, among other bands. And you look at the way he builds the driven element. He builds the driven element as half of a folded dipole. In other words, the right-hand side is folded back, as if he's building a full folded dipole, but he only does it on the right-hand side. Center conductor goes to that repeater.
Time out.
Center conductor of the coax goes to the right-hand side, and the shield goes to the center of the dipole, and the dipole is now one continuous piece, and it doesn't have a slot in the center. There's zillions of ways of building a dipole, and that folded dipole approach that I'm now describing, by disturbing the spacing between the folding portion of the tape, the folded dipole portion, by putting a stray capacitor right where it joins, you're literally putting a stray capacitor across the end of the coaxial cable, and the stray capacitor can be made by copper tape and bit longer. And so that's another kind of very exotic ballon, extremely simple mechanically. But once you study the way Ken Britton does it on that website, and now the next step beyond that is to make the twin lead feed of this thing be a coaxial, make it out of the foil itself. So now the transmission line could be the foil coming down the window shade, and now the thing really folds up easily. I'll admit it's going to take a lot more fiddling to make the foil into the transmission line. At first, I would stick with the coaxial cable as the transmission line. Wes wanted to make a comment on this. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
I don't know exactly how the gentleman did that, but it's pretty easy. The aluminium alarm system foil antenna comes with the paper. So you peel out the paper and then you carefully line that on the window. And you can have any direction you want to, and then you simply fold it at whatever the angle you want to. So you can have either 2 meter dipole or the 2 meter J-pole antenna, and the dipole is actually the easiest to be described and built. It takes the piece of tape, a bit longer than 1 meter, apply into the window, then cut in the centimeter from each of the two elements, and then you get the traditional dipole. But how to connect the end to the crusher cable? Well, in order to attach the feed line to each side of the cut, you use a foil blocks. Foil blocks is a piece of plastic. It has the two contacts on it. It comes with the two contacts. And what you do is you peel the paper from the foil block, and you carefully pull it on the end. So actually you have to break it down because, not necessarily. If you put it horizontally, so each foil comes to it, it would also work. But usually how it was done, so it's secure, the end of the foil came to the certain point, was a little bit folded back, like 1/8 of an inch. Then on that very small edge, 1/8 of an inch, you put on the top of it foil block. So the foil block, where most of the surface was sticking to the window and was holding it. On the top of the foil block, you have a screw with the plate on it. Then what you're going to do is you already have a support from the foil, so it's not going to go from beneath of the foil block. It's kind of hold with it. Now you bench that foil, and then that bended foil you simply slide between the two brackets and tie the screws on it. Now, before you tie the screw, you put the coaxial cable, the inner or the breadboard, and that's how you make it pretty good. But my question to you is, I didn't quite understand how do you do the tuning. Could you simply add additional vertical piece of the foil, and then you cut with the blade, and then you do this way the tuning circuit? If you could explain that.
Yeah, you've gone one step beyond, though, Wes. You're having him tape the dipole to the glass of the window itself, which is another approach. He was taping the dipole to a window shade so he could roll it up and then install it on any window he wants, or he could roll it up, put it under his arm, walk to somebody else's house, reinstall the shade, and he's got an antenna. So he was building a portable antenna, and once you solve the design of the antenna, there's nothing stopping you from placing it to the glass. When it comes to tuning a dipole antenna, the tuning procedure of any kind of a dipole, whether it's made out of foil, whether it's made out of aluminum rods, whether it's made out of welding rods, doesn't matter. By taking a so-called tuning tool consists of a wooden, thin, long piece of wood, similar similar to a barbecue skewer, the thing that you make shish kebab on. The wooden rods you can buy in your supermarket used for making shish kebab. You take one of those wooden rods, take a piece of copper tape or aluminum tape, doesn't matter, make it, let me pick a number, inch and a half long, and you stick it on the end of the rod, of your wooden rod. Now you hold that object near the tip of the dipole. Let me drop. As you're watching the standing wave ratio of the antenna, you've got your standing wave ratio meter set in the reverse mode. You're looking at the amount of reflected power. While you're watching that meter, you take this tuning tool with a piece of tape on the end of it, and you start holding it near the tips of the dipole. When you do that, you're adding capacitance to the tip. You are electronically lengthening the dipole when you do that. As you do that, the standing wave ratio will either improve or do the opposite of improve. It'll get worse. It'll go one way or the other. No matter which way it goes, it's telling you a very valuable piece of information. If you find out that when you bring your tuning tool near the tip of the dipole, the VisWire gets worse, that tells you the dipole is too long. You walk over there with your X-Acto knife and you peel up the end of the foil and fold it back a little bit. You've electronically shortened the dipole without permanently changing it. You just fold it back. And now repeat the process. And as you adjust the length until you get the best VisWire, by adjusting the length of the dipole, by folding it back with the copper tape, or adding extra tape to it. By the way, you can always lengthen the dipole by just simply taking another piece of tape and laying it on top of the tip that's already there. And don't worry about the glue and how well it makes contact. Let me drop. Don't worry about how well it makes contact. It doesn't matter. The tip of the dipole has an impedance of 1,500 ohms. Even if it's only the glue of the tape making contact, when you lay another piece of tape on top of the dipole to make it an inch longer, so to speak, and you only got the, with your own meter, you find out the new piece of tape you've added is not making electrical contact. It's just sitting there by way of the glue and making extra capacitance. Because the impedance out there is so high, it doesn't matter. You've electrically lengthened it. And even if you soldered it down, you'd see nothing would happen, if you know what I mean. So by adding pieces of tape, you can make it longer. By folding it back, you can make it shorter. By holding the tuning tool near the tip, you know immediately is your dipole too long or too short. So you do that tuning procedure until you get the dipole the lowest VisWire you can get with only tuning the length. The next step is to now make a phony gimmick capacitor in the center of the dipole, if it's a split-type dipole, making a phony capacitor in the center by again having a piece of overlay plastic tape, copper tape, where one side is directly connected to that half of the dipole, the other side is laying on top of a piece of scotch tape. The scotch tape is the dielectric. So you can make a variable capacitor in the center, you can make a variable length out of the tips, and when you juggle those two procedures back and forth, by way of the article that I told you where to get the article, you'll get a perfect, and I mean perfect. If your VisWire meter has high enough directivity, you can make a dipole have a 1.001 standing wave ratio by that tuning procedure. Wonder if some of this makes some sense, John. For the time being, I would recommend, let me drop.
WSLAN.
Paul recognized, gets you in a second. For the time being, I would recommend he stick with the coaxial cable, because as he adds another variable by building a phony twin lead out of aluminum tape, until he gets the gap just right to get the impedance right, now the length of the transmission line, he may end up with a piece of 73-ohm transmission line, so to speak, on a 50-ohm dipole. And now the length of the transmission line and the spacing between the two halves is another variable that makes life a little bit complicated. Stick with the coax at first. But once he's got this fold-up dipole on the left side, on the inside and the outside of the roll-up shade, and he's got them at right angles to each other, so thoroughly decoupled, and once he uses these tuning procedures, he can make his dipole perfect. The tuning procedure I just told you about for a dipole, which is explained in that article, a 1,500-word article on the bottom of that webpage, Whiskey Alpha, to the A1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. You go to that website, and you'll see the article telling you the specifics of how to do this tuning. This tuning procedure for a dipole, I've tried to get that article published in QST magazine. Every time I've tried, they've turned me down. They assume that everybody out there knows how to tune a dipole. They assume that this is old-fashioned and boring information. Each time I give a talk on this particular subject, people say, why hasn't somebody told me that earlier? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
You got to do one side of the dipole, and then you got to, you know, say you're going to shorten it, you know, pull the capacitor up, and you're going to shorten it. Now you go to the other side, are you going to get a different reading? Is it going to say you're going to make that side longer? You know, you can't be doing both sides at one time. That's a little confusing. And also, if the dipole is not made out of tape, but let's say it's just made out of wire, 12-gauge wire or whatever, and you have insulation on this, when you say fold it back, you know, you've got to fold it back an inch, are you assuming that this wire does not have any insulation on it? When you fold it back, if it's that insulation, I don't think you're really changing the length, are you? Back to you there.
You've used good common sense, Paul, and your common sense in this case, it's a non-logical situation. It's led you astray. I don't care if your dipole is made out of 14-gauge wire or 30-gauge wire. I don't care if the wire is insulated. I don't care if your dipole is made out of inch-wide tape or an eighth of an inch-wide tape. Whenever you take the tips of that dipole and fold it back, electronically it is a shorter dipole. Whether it's insulated or not, doesn't matter. The impedance out of the tip is 1,500 ohms. The fact that you folded it back has made a shorter dipole. If you got the right kind of a balancing device in the center of the dipole, whether or not you make the dipole symmetric doesn't matter. You don't have to feed the dipole exactly in the center if you got the right kind of a balance. You can feed it in the center, 10% off to one side, 50% off to one side, or you can feed the outer edge. There's nothing magic as long as you get the right kind of a balance. If you want to be a purist, if you find out that by the folding procedure you want the dipole to be 1 inch shorter, and you want to do it in a symmetric manner, and you fold back a half inch on the right side and fold a half inch back on the left side, that's your choice. But with the right kind of a balance, it doesn't matter. But whether you're making it out of wire, whether you're making it out of rod, whether you're making it out of tape, whenever you fold it back, it is shorter. Whenever you add an extra piece, even if it's an insulated piece of metallic piece, the dipole becomes longer because the impedance out there is so high and the amount of capacitance you get through the form bar insulation, so to speak, is so high, it is electronically connected, even though your ohmmeter won't confirm that. Ain't that crazy, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a 40-minute dipole, 80-minute dipole, and I always make mine about 6 inches longer on each side, you know, whatever the number might be, like 80 meters, what, 134 for the whole half wave. So then I always make it really around 135, and then I just fold it back. But I'm thinking the whole time that this thing is really 135. I just happened to make it longer, and my antenna tuner is able to take it out. But you're saying that by folding it back, I'm really making, you know, folding it back 6 inches on each side, it's really now 134 feet, even so it's got insulation on it. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Paul. What you could have done if you wanted to start off with 136 feet of wire, connect your egg insulator not at the tip, by whatever means you connect the insulator 1, 2, 3 feet back from the tip is where you connect the egg insulator and wrap the wire at that time. And the extra length of wire, you let it hang down at a 90-degree angle. Or you take the extra length of wire and you stretch it straight out and wrap it around the rope that goes to the tree. The egg insulator goes to the wire on one side, it goes to the rope that goes to the tree on the other side. And let the piece of wire wrap around that rope. So that now the dipole is long. As you start taking the portion of the wire that is wrapped around the rope, and you unwrap some of it and fold it back near the egg insulator, electronically you have made the dipole shorter. when the dipole, when the extra length is laying down at a 90 degree angle towards the ground, it's still adding length. Only when you fold it back all the way so that it's parallel to the rest of the dipole, even if it's insulated, at the instant it's folded back, it becomes electronically shorter. I know that's opposite of common sense, but that's the way it works electronically. So you can literally tune the dipole by this folding procedure without ever cutting the wire, without ever rewrapping the egg insulator, if you know what I mean. Does that make some sense, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW.
Okay, I've been listening to this net for I don't know how long, and you probably said this a million times, but that's the first time I really got it. Very good, very well done. It got me. I just figured that, you know, if that thing was, no matter how long it was, if it was folded back, it wouldn't matter. It's just, you know, kind of like making a coil or something. It's just, you know, but you're saying by folding it back, I mean, mechanically I do that naturally because, you know, I want it to hold to the, well, in my case, I use PVC for an insulator. So, you know, I drill, you know, I take a piece of small PVC, you know, inch and a half PVC, just drill a couple of holes on one side, a couple of holes on the other side, and spread the 12-gauge wire through it, come back, and by coming back and then twisting itself back onto itself, that mechanically holds it, and then the other side of the PVC is tied to the rope, and that goes to the trees, or pulleys, or whatever I got. Okay, Dick, understood. Back to that.
Let me go one step further with this, Paul, and tell you something that really is exciting to me, and it's opposite of common sense. If I'm building a tape dipole, I've got copper tape, and I'm laying it down on printed circuit board, G10 board, that has no foil anywhere. So it's a piece of fiberglass board, or it could be a piece of plastic, it could be a piece of fiberglass, it could be a piece of plexiglass, doesn't matter. Yes, if it's a thick piece of plexiglass, I've got some extra capacitance, the dipole ends up shorter. That's a minor detail. So I'm laying the copper tape down on a piece of fiberglass. And I know that I started off with the copper tape a little bit too long. And I'm now looking at the standing wave ratio. I could be looking at the reflective power with a bird watt meter, or I could be staring at the screen of a vector network analyzer. There's lots of ways I could do it. So I'm looking at reflective power from the dipole. And I decide the dipole is a little bit too long. Intentionally, I made it too long. I go over there with my X-Acto knife, and I peel up approximately 1 inch of the end of the tip of the dipole. This is on 900 megacycles, we'll say. It could be on 2 meters. So I peel up 1 inch. By peeling up 1 inch of the tape that used to be stuck down to the fiberglass board, I've now picked it up a 16th of an inch from the board. It's still there, but it's not making contact to the board. While I'm watching the spectrum analyzer, vector network analyzer, standing wave ratio meter, whatever, while I'm watching reflected power, with that skewer, little thin diameter wooden stick in my hand, the kind that you buy in the supermarket for making a shish kebab, and I'm using the sharp point of that, I stick the sharp point under the copper tape that was a 16th of an inch spaced, the tip of a dipole, the portion that was above the fiberglass. Because I'm doing this with this thin little diameter stick, and I'm standing a foot away from it, my body doesn't affect the measurement. The stick has almost no measurement. I stick the tip of the stick.
Repeater, time out.
I stick the tip of the stick underneath the copper tape, the portion that's a 16th of an inch above the copper, above the fiberglass board. While I'm watching instrumentation, I start carefully folding it back. At first, I fold it up at, say, a 30-degree angle, a 60-degree angle, a 90-degree angle. I'm pushing it with the stick, and then I fold it back a 120-degree angle, a 160-degree angle, and finally a 180-degree angle. As I take that piece of copper tape, and as I'm doing that folding operation of the last inch, I will watch the visual on the screen continuously change. As I change that angle, I'll watch the tip of the dipole electronically, continuously becomes shorter and shorter. That's opposite of common sense, of course. That's the way it acts electronically. You get the full length when it's laying out straight. and you start tilting it up at a 30 or a 60 degree angle, the last inch, and you see the length of the dipole electronically get shorter. And as I start folding it back all the way so that it now is parallel on top, so to speak, I folded it 180 degrees, I see the dipole continuously get shorter and shorter. And that folding operation, whether I'm doing it with tape or whether I'm doing it with wire, doesn't matter. The dipole doesn't see the length anymore when it's been folded back. Your common sense, your brain says, hey, I just simply made a funny kind of a coil. I have electronically shortened that dipole as I folded it back. Ain't that crazy, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
It is. And one of these nets, we'll have to go get into the reason that happened. You know? Yeah. I mean, physically, it looks like the electrons are going down to the end of that wire, no matter where it is, whether it's straight out, straight up, or folded back, and then being reflected back. But in this case, it's going up to the where it's bending, where the bend is at 180 degrees, and it's stopping there, and then it's reflecting back. That is amazing. Back to that.
You got a call, and you just made a beautiful mental image. Those electrons spread down that piece of copper tape, and when they hit that 180-degree bend, for all practical purposes, they don't go any further. They think that is the end of the dipole. In reality, the dipole folds back a little bit. They don't see that part that folds back. That's crazy. But that's the way it acts. You watch it on the instrumentation. As you do that, you'll say, wow. I'm not quite sure why. What Mother Nature is telling me, it's a very strong message. I'm getting the message. I don't know how the hell she's doing that. So by way of this piece of stick in your hand and the folding procedure, you can continuously changing the length of the dipole. By way of a piece of tape in the center of the dipole, where you're shunting the piece of tape across the gap, so to speak, but there's this piece of scotch tape over one side, so it's not a short circuit, and again you're folding back that piece, you're making the continuously variable capacitor. So with one stick in your left hand when you're changing the variable capacitor in the center, with the other stick in your right hand when you're changing the length of the dipole, and you juggle those two back and forth, and all of a sudden the VisWire goes to 1:1, and you find the perfect match. Once you find the perfect match, then you've got to disturb things a little bit to make it permanent so that are you really going to cut off the tape at that length, or are you really going to cut off the length of the extra capacitor in the center, so to speak? You're going to make a more permanent, physically robust technique. But once you find the solution electronically by this bending process with a wooden stick, you can make every dipole, whether it's a dipole in free space, whether it's a dipole 1 foot above the ground, whether it's a dipole buried in the middle of your Yagi antenna or in the middle of your quad Yagi antenna, doesn't matter. No matter where the hell that dipole is, you use this tuning procedure, you can always make the impedance match of your dipole repeated. Time out. There are lots of people who think that if your dipole ends up with, let me pick a number, a 93 ohm impedance, that they now must have a 1.5-to-1 balun in order to do an impedance match. Absolutely not. Whatever baluning device you're using, whatever impedance it comes out at, as long as you're willing to electronically change the length of the dipole and electronically change the amount of capacitance in the center without changing anything physical in the way you feed the dipole, you can always make the dipole a perfect impedance match. Why the hell is that such a well-kept secret? How come no one has ever told us that up till now? Why is that not an article? It is a published article on the bottom of WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. The K2RIW explanation. It's there. It's the only place I know of where it's published. Other than that, it's a well-kept secret. And don't tell anybody, Paul. KC2WGB, K2RIW. You got into a great subject here, John. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I'm afraid I let you guys go astray by not interpreting this drawing correctly here. It's a drawing over a drawing so that you can show me the visualization of the two antennas on the shade. But what I see now is these are two quarter wave verticals that he has constructed here. That's why he's using that wire in the sense that he's using it.
Okay.
So it makes that much difference, and it's interesting about the dipole effect, but he has two ground plane antennas here is what he's doing.
Well, what in the world is the counterpoise? Why in the world isn't that a full half-wave dipole fed wherever he wants to feed it? To try to build onto a shade through a window, to try to build a quarter-wave ground plane antenna, to try to come up with the right kind of a counterpoise is extremely difficult. I don't recommend he do that. What is the counterpoise there, John? Go ahead.
Oh, okay, Dick. Well, don't forget, the two middle one is working fine. What he did for the counterpoise, he has the vertical element, and then below that, set at 45 degrees, he has what looks like approximately a 2-inch wide piece of aluminum foil tape on both sides, making the counterpoise elements. Yep, and he has that on both structures. Okay, back to you, Dick.
Okay, so he's got a kind of a half-wave dipole. Just the bottom half of the dipole is split into two separate pieces, at a 45-degree angle to the right and a 45-degree angle to the left. That's a good antenna. So he really has built a slightly mechanical difference of half-wave dipole. And yes, the radiator has, let me pick a number of 35 ohm impedance because it's one vertical piece. The so-called counterpoise, instead of having 35 ohms, is 20 ohms because it's two separate pieces, 45 degrees to the left and 45 degrees to the right. Electronically, in my mind, that is a half-wave dipole. He's made it vertically polarized. That's a very nice way of doing it. So whether he makes it a real half-wave dipole and he makes it either horizontal or vertical, whichever he likes, brings the coax cable away from the center at a right angle, that's one approach, or whether he builds a half-folded dipole, like the WA5BJB article, that's another choice, or now he's got a kind of a poor man's equivalent of a quarter-wave ground plane, where his ground plane is two separate radials, and by adjusting the right length of those radials and the right length of the radiator, and by this tuning procedure we just described, and by putting the straight capacitance in the center, as he juggles that, he will get a perfect impedance match. That's a very nice antenna. And a roll-up shade, where now it is thoroughly portable. He rolls up the shade, he disconnects it from the window, he goes to somebody else's house, he reinstalls the shade, or he goes to a hospital and reinstalls the shade, and now he's got an antenna. Rich N2EO can really use an antenna like that. It's time that Barry built him one of those. I've been telling Rich to get a hold of him. Let me drop a call. What I did when I was in the hospital for 3 days back in December is I had my son bring me a piece of RG58 cable. Oh, that was about 20 feet long. And I stripped the last 19 inches of it. I stripped the shield back for 19 inches and made the center conductor with its insulation stick out for 19 inches. And then I hung that with a piece of string on a tack against the wall. And that was up on near the window, about 5 feet higher than me in the bed. The coax cable ran across the floor, tape on the floor so that people wouldn't, tape to the floor so that people wouldn't trip over it. Came over to the handy-talkie, and the handy-talkie was now held up against my ear, and I listened to a very noisy signal of this repeater to find out what was happening. So I was telling Rich to get a hold of Barry to have him bring him a piece of RG58 cable to give him a better equivalent of a rubber duck by hanging it high in the ceiling where he is. They could 10 dB more signal. This tape dipole thing on the window shade is another great approach. There was a roll-up window shade on the hospital room where I was. Over to you, John. We got into a darn good subject here. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the deck there.
Oh, you're right, Dick. Very interesting and young guy. And he's got a very interesting thing here because his mother doesn't want this stuff visible. So when he's done, he rolls up the shade, and like you said, he can move it. But you also brought up another interesting point. I think he should also try a J-pole. He could probably do a better job and get a better structure out of a J-pole than he can with this, even though it's working. What do you think of that tape?
Okay. Will I be happier if I marry a blonde or a brunette or a redhead? Will I be happier if I use the tape in a J-pole manner, use the tape in a full dipole manner, or use the tape in a quasi-ground plane manner where the counterpoise is two split halves of the dipole? All three will work equally well if you carry it out to the end. All three will have the exact same gain. All three will have the exact same impedance. As long as you dot the I's and cross the T's and do the right impedance match and the right kind of a balancing function, they all will work like a charm, John. So he's got at least three approaches here. Some of those approaches require a little bit more tape on the window shade, but all of them will work. And one of the things that I recently ran into, the person who hired me as a consultant was looking at a whole bunch of antennas. You could buy little miniature antennas for the 2.4 gig band. He's running a 802.11-like radio system. And for his particular environment, the FCC-approved antennas, there's about 20 FCC-approved antennas out there he could buy. Let me drop. And some of those antennas are rated 0 dB over isotropic. 0 dB, 1 dB, one of them is 2 dB, one of them is 2.2 dB, and it's almost electronically the exact same antenna. A little bit of a different physical arrangement, a little bit different physical balancing and whatever. But these various brands had various gain factors. And he was saying, oh, I want the 2.2 dB gain antenna. I don't want the 1 dB gain antenna because that's 2.2 times better. And he was therefore selecting that. And I said, boy, wait a minute there, John. I think the guy's name was John. I was saying, you're being sucked in. There's a very dirty little secret here. A high percentage of the antennas of this type being manufactured in the United States, the gain number is set in the advertising department, not set in the measurement laboratory, because the manufacturer realizes that a hell of a lot of those customers are looking at the decibels per dollar. And they think that a 2.2 dB gain antenna is 2.5 times better than a 1 dB gain antenna, and they're getting more bang for the dollar. They believe that. Well, some of those antennas, if they told the truth, really have 0 dB of gain. And after you try to calculate dBs per dollar, and you're dividing by 0, you get an antenna that's infinity. How the hell do you use that antenna? So what I'm getting at is his real two choices were 2 dB versus 1 dB. And in reality, because it's a logarithmic function, the real difference in gain, if they were telling the truth, would only be 26%. A 2 dB gain antenna is not twice as good as a 1 dB gain antenna. He didn't know that. It's only 26% better if they're telling the truth. And when you get the exact same kind of antenna, but a little bit of different physical layout by brand A, and brand B calls it 2.2 dB of gain, and brand A calls it 1.0 dB of gain, is there really a difference? Hell no. Let me drop. The real communication path he was trying to cover was going to have a free space loss of 80 decibels. And when you got 80 decibels of loss, and you look at the power spread of the radio he was using, he's buying this printed circuit radio, which has either plus 3 dBm of transmit power or plus 23 dBm of the two choices you could buy. And one of them had minus 85 dB of sensitivity on the receiver, and the other one had minus 90. So you look at the real power spread, the number of decibels between the transmit power in dBm versus receiver sensitivity in dBm, that's power spread. And where he had, let me pick a number, 105 dB of power spread, and he's trying to overcome 80 dB of free space loss, and the difference between 80 and 105 is 25 dB. He's got 25 decibels of fade margin. So in other words, when he installs the antenna, he can tolerate 25 dB of loss because of shrub foliage, or insertion loss of the window of the house or the wall of the house. When he's got 25 dB of power fade margin and 105 dB or even greater of power spread, whether he's using a 1 dB antenna or a 2 dB antenna, he's spinning in the ocean. It doesn't matter how you lay out the antenna. And how you lay out the path between the transmitter and the receiver is what counts. And so decibels of gain, I told him, for the kinds of antennas he's buying, do not look at the decibel gain.
It's probable you lie, and even if they're telling you the truth, it's a very minor difference between brand A, brand B, brand C, and brand D, if you know what I mean. Choose the antenna.